Calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance. We're in the bunker right here, back at the helm of the ship. It's the 24th of August. That's right, 24th. Moon's Day, and we're off and running again. We had a good respite, got some relaxation, some paperwork done, and so forth and so on. But I promised you we're going to get into this history of the Soviet Russia. And I just got the book that I ordered, that I had, but lost it loaning it out. And I'm going to read today from George von Rausch's book, 6th edition. It's 550 pages. It's got all the stuff in the back, all the footnotes, everything, and sources and maps and you name it. I think anybody interested in Russia and Germany and World War II should have a copy of this book. Okay, I'm going to pick out of here something I think that's important. The eve, and that's the speculation on whether Russia was going to attack Germany. Of course, remember, Russia had never attacked a strong country. They only attacked weak countries. And so Germany was pretty much at the top of their game by this time, as far as military hardware and so forth. It doesn't even make sense that Stalin would have gambled that. He was still quite interested in keeping the Russia-German pact because they needed money and they needed food, they needed gold and so forth. And Germany needed a lot of things from Russia, too. Germany did not respond to these gestures, and Moscow's resulting uneasiness became more pronounced when the news of Rudolf Hess's flight to England became known. It was believed that as Hitler's personal emissary, he had been ordered to arrange an alliance between Germany and Great Britain against the Soviet Union. In consequence, several things occurred which could be taken as harbingers of a coming war. Air raid drills were intensified. Foreign diplomats were restricted in their movements. Foreigners were refused travel permits. Pravda repeatedly reminded the people of their patriotic duties. There were troop reinforcements, noticeably on the Western Front, especially in the neighborhood of Lwów. In the last days of April, Count Schellenberg returned to Berlin, taking with him the Russian offer to deliver 5 million metric tons of grain in 1942. Normally, you don't do something like that if you're planning on invading a country. He strongly advocates the maintenance of peace between Germany and Russia and attempted to convince Hitler that the Russian troop concentrations along the border were prompted by the Russian desire for security and that Stalin was prepared for further cooperation with Germany and for further economic concessions. It was in vain. Hitler had already made his decision. Throughout April, there had been an increasing number of protest notes because of border violations, mainly by airplanes. Both sides were trying to explore the strength of the foe. 150 German divisions stood on Russia's western border. They faced a slightly larger number of Russian divisions. On April 4th, Stalin received a warning from Churchill in London that a German attack was planned for June the 22nd. Stalin did not quite believe it, but he decided to make one last attempt at clearing the air. I remember when Barbarossa broke out and the German divisions invaded Russia, Stalin was so shocked that Germany and Hitler had attacked him that he went into seclusion for 10 days. Now, I can't say that I can prove that, but that's supposedly what happened, because he didn't believe that Hitler would attack him. On June 14th, the Soviet telegraph agency TASS issued a statement in which Sir Stafford Cripps, British ambassador to Moscow, was violently attacked for circulating rumors regarding an imminent war between Russia and Germany. All rumors according to which Germany had made territorial and economic demands on the Soviet Union, which had been rejected by the Soviet government, were denied. The German and Russian troops were about to commence hostilities was a false and preposterous provocation. Actually, no demands had been made by Berlin. But it seems that Stalin was waiting for them and wanted to see whether the TASS statement would break the spell of silence between Berlin and Moscow. When Schellenberg was at Molotov's office at 9:30 p.m. on June the 21st, the latter mentioned the war rumors and pointed out that with some regret that Germany had not taken any notice of the TASS statement. Why was Germany dissatisfied? What had caused this tension? The German ambassador was unable to reply to this and said he would ask Berlin. A few hours later, he handed the Soviet commissar for foreign affairs Hitler's declaration of war. In other words, the Russians, Stalin would say, hey, what the hell's going on here? What's happening? I mean, you know. The question has been raised whether Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union forestalled a Soviet attack, i.e., whether or not this was a preventive war. As proof of the Russian desire for war, statements by Soviet Russian officers and functionaries had been quoted, as well as affidavits of German generals, from which it had been inferred that the Soviet government planned or at least contemplated an offensive use of its troops stationed along the western frontier. Of course, there's always all kinds of rumors in a situation like this. The massing of very mobile troop units, including cavalry, on the borders gives one pause. However, their location in the northwest and southwest of Russia conspicuously points to the probability that they were to serve as military support for Russia's political demands of November and December of 1940. If Germany were to show herself ready to renew negotiations and were to grant the Soviet Union the freedom of action it desired against Finland and the Balkans, these units could have been used for an advance in those directions, not for an attack against Germany! As a matter of fact, the massing of Russian forces on the western border was intended, in a sense, as a means of pressure. The Soviet Union wished to discourage Hitler from his aggressive intentions and to increase his own political weight, its own political weight. That Hitler was not to be frightened by these measures but went over to the attack irresponsibly and boundlessly, underestimating the Soviet potential on the basis of the Finnish war, came as a complete surprise to the Soviet government. A Soviet assault on Germany in the summer of 1941, at a time the United States had not yet entered the war and Hitler seemed invincible, would have been lunacy. If to Stalin and Ribbentrop, Molotov Pact meant time gained, and it did indeed mean that, it was not with a view to an early entry into the war, but to strengthen the Soviet potential under protection of war between the capitalist powers. Both the pact with Germany as well as the alliance with the Western powers from 1941 on must not blind us to the fact that for the Bolsheviks, the war which began in 1939 represented the long hoped for conflict among the capitalist states, which could become the springboard for world revolution. By patiently biding his time, Stalin could expect to achieve more than by a premature participation in the war. The war worked for the Soviet Union only after the Axis powers and the Western Allies had torn each other to shreds and Germany was finally vanquished. And that's what I tell you. That's the time that Stalin would spring into action. That's what he wanted to do. Perhaps with the help of the United States, only then, perhaps at the 11th hour, Stalin must have thought would be the moment for a Russian intervention have arrived, then only in order to share in the loot. This was Stalin's tactic in 1939 in the Polish campaign and again in 1945 in the war against Japan. He presumably also planned to act that way in the West struggle with Hitler. Like I've said, Russia never went after strong nations. Always waited till they tore themselves apart with civil war or a war with some other country, and when they're down on their knees, then Soviets would march in. That's why I say that that's totally out of character with Stalin, and that it was simply Hitler's war of aggression. He just up and did it, which essentially lost everything in the end. Between Hitler's misunderstanding of the industrial might and development in the United States and how soon they could tool up, for one thing, how fast they could supply Russia. In fact, if there hadn't been some lingering fear of the communists and Russia in the West, they would have been supplied much faster, and it would have been even a bigger loss for Germany. The other problem was Hitler's bungling of the situation in the first place, with his waste of 1 million men at Leningrad, which was totally, that was totally because he wanted to insult Stalin. And, I mean, you know, gambling that much on a personal vendetta? Crazy. He could have been in Moscow and been warming their feet at the fire in the Kremlin months earlier. On June 22, 1941, at 4 o'clock in the morning, German troops suddenly invaded Russia without warning. On February 3, Hitler had approved the plan of campaign against the Soviet Union. At first, the date was left open. On April 1, it was planned for sometime during the second half of June. On June 6, Hitler fixed the date at June 22. According to some reports, June 12 had been originally set, but as a result of Hungary's refusal to march, a 10-day postponement became necessary. World public opinion had been skillfully deceived as to Hitler's war plans. Many signs seemed to indicate that the summer of 1941 would be employed mainly in stepping up the Mediterranean offensive. The German victory in Yugoslavia, the landing on Crete, and Rommel's successes in Libya all combined to support such an assumption. Among the German leaders, Göring was well known as a vigorous exponent of these plans. Göring was always overrated and always a braggadocious guy, and his Air Force could do anything, and there's nothing that they couldn't do, like losing the Battle of Britain because of the air power. And I think I remember in Russia, he was going to drop in there and save everybody too. Got so cold that they couldn't keep the planes in the air. They had to have fires underneath the planes to keep the oil from becoming so hard that the plane wouldn't start. It was a terrible situation. That's from a book called, I think it's the one I have called I Flew for the Fuhrer. And from personal information I obtained from a good friend of mine who was a pilot in the Air Force, German Air Force, on the Eastern Front. He was there the last days and just got out, barely got out with his life. They had pulled everything out, headed back to Germany, and he was still up there fighting for a while. And it's quite the stories that he used to tell me. Unfortunately, I never could get him to sit down and let me tape him because he had a wealth of information on the Eastern Front. Anyhow, the Reichsmarshal had warned against an attack on Russia and recommended concentrating military action in the Mediterranean theater of war. Well, he was right there. When a German-Turkish mutual defense pact was signed in Ankara on June 18th, rumors arose about the German troop movements from the Balkans in the direction of the Near East. There were also reports of a march of German troops through the Ukraine, also with the Near East as their destination. The rumors hid the real meaning of the troop concentrations on the Russian frontier. Hitler's plan of campaign had been outlined in a general way as early as December 18, 1940. It called for the destruction of the bulk of the Russian army in western Russia by deep thrusts of web-shaped tank units, the retreat of Russian combat troops into the vast Russian hinterland was to be prevented. A line was quickly to be reached stretching roughly from Arkhangelsk to Astrakhan, making attacks by the Russian Air Force impossible. For Germans, the line would form a base for aerial bombardment of the industrial region in the Urals Hitler was quite convinced that his plan would be successful, and a Führer Directive number 32 of June 11th dealt with military measures to be taken against England after the conquest of Russia had been completed. You know, when you bite off more than you can chew, you fail. I mean, you know, if he'd have kept the pact with Russia and concentrated on England, England on her knees, the United States would have not entered the war. They might have, they might have blustered and yelled and screamed, but with Russia out of the picture, how are they going to supply the armies, you know, like they did later on? The Soviet troops stationed in Russia's western border were overwhelmed by the surprise German attack in the wake of heavy bombing raids aimed at the airfields close to the border, and which had thrown the Russian air defense into confusion. Another indication that Soviet Russia was not inclined to invade Germany, it wasn't even inclined to properly protect itself. Hitler's army stormed into Russia in three great columns in the dawn of June 22nd. A central army group advanced in a pincer movement from East Prussia and from Poland in direction of Minsk. Simultaneously, a southern group crossed the Prut and invaded the Ukraine, while a northern group entered and occupied the Baltic states and threatened northwest Russia. The German Air Force attacked targets far behind the front. At the same time, German planes appeared over the skies, the ports of Baltic and the Arctic and the Black Sea. Simultaneously, Italy, Romania, and Slovakia declared war against Russia on June... See, it sounds more like these people are taking advantage of the situation and going to try to share in the spoils of war. On June 25th, Finland followed the German example. Hungary followed suit on June 27th. Stalin, in spite of the tense international situation, had left Moscow on June 11th, perhaps as a gesture to help lessen tension. He was accompanied by Malenkov and Voznesky. In Moscow, Molotov was in charge. He silently listened to the German ambassador, who handed him Hitler's declaration of war on June 22nd at 4 a.m. Then he remarked abruptly, "It is war. Your aircraft have just bombarded some 10 open villages. Do you believe that we deserve that?" Schellenberg had instructions not to engage in any discussions. Now, you see, that's an interesting question by Stalin. I mean, not quite fitting his ability to be really mean. I mean, you know, why are you bombing our open villages? Well, because they could. That's why, Stalin. A few hours later, Molotov broadcast an announcement of the German attack to the Russian people. Stalin at first remained silent. Like I said, he had been in shock. For the purpose of coordinating all defense measures, a State Committee for Defense was organized on June 30th, which was in the nature of the War Cabinet and constituted the supreme executive organ. In addition to Stalin, Molotov and Voronchilov, Beria and Malenkov were its members. Malenkov had recently become one of Stalin's closest collaborations, and of course he became leader of Russia later on, in the General Secretariat of the party. All members of the State Committee were also members of the Politburo. At the front, operations were in the hands of three proven military leaders of long standing. Timoshenko was in command in the central sector, Voroshilov in the north, and Budyiny in the south. However, they failed to slow the rapid advance of the Germans and their allies. After a tremendous tank battle near Smolensk, the forward thrust of the German attack in the central sector seemed somewhat weakened. But in the Ukraine, the fiercest of the great encircling battles of the opening campaign developed before Kiev. In September, after catastrophic losses, Budyiny was forced to retreat. The Soviet leadership had committed the fatal error of deploying too many troops too close to the front. giving the Germans a chance to annihilate them into gigantic battles by closing in on them, a double pincer movement. The number of prisoners rose to hundreds of thousands. At Kiev, it exceeded 500,000. Now, how would you take care of 500,000 troops? I mean, you know, you can capture them, but then you got to feed them something and give them some housing or something. Even if you made them like Eisenhower, did the Germans make them lay out in the field and make them dig holes in the ground to try to survive? So when you talk about some of these other leaders being so brutal, you better look at Eisenhower and those guys and what they did. And Operation Keelhaul, too, where the American leadership forced thousands and thousands of anti-communists back into the Soviet Union to be put in Siberia and so forth, and or killed, just lined up and shot. You can't trust any of these people. Remember that. Trust no one, especially people with power. By the end of October, the Germans had reached the line formed by the towns of Kursk, Kharkov, Stalino, and Takhanrog. In the middle of November, the Isthmus of Perekhov was stormed, and Rostov, the gate of the Caucasus, was conquered. The advance in the central sector had again reached full speed. The Battle of Bryansk was followed by the occupation of Orel, Tula, Vyazma, and Rzhev. On October 15th, the German armored division stormed Mozysk, east of Moscow. Then immediately outside the Russian capital, the advance came to a halt. In the north, the Germans had advanced as far as Leningrad. They occupied Schlussenburg, east of the old capital. The siege of Leningrad had begun. Would it be followed by the siege or conquest of Moscow? Well, no, it shouldn't be followed by. It should be, Moscow should have been first, for Christ's sake. You know, I've never been to a military academy or anything like that, but I can read history and see how a lot of these military people and the things they did was absolutely ludicrous. On July 3rd, Stalin made a momentous radio appeal to the people. He frankly admitted that the Soviet Union was in mortal danger. The situation was too serious for comforting words. However, he felt the need to justify his policy. He raised the question of whether the Soviet Union had made a mistake in concluding a non-aggression pact with Germany. He answered in the negative and pointed out the advantages which had at first resulted from the move. For a year and a half, the country had been assured of peace and had thus been in a position to continue its military preparations. He could also have mentioned the territorial gains achieved by the Soviet Union between 1938 and 1940. He made the point that Hitler's troops had been fully mobilized on the outbreak of the war with Soviet Union, while his, on the other hand, had not. By stressing the fact that Soviet Union had been surprised by Hitler's attack, he sought to awaken in the people a feeling of moral superiority. In his appeal to the people's will to resist, he adroitly combined national and social arguments. The cruel and implacable enemy had set out, he said, to conquer the soil which Soviet peasants had tilled in the sweat of their brow and to Germanize the peoples of the Soviet Union. He was out to turn the people of the Soviet Union into the slaves of the German princes and barons and to restore the rule of the landlords and the czars in Russia. Well, this is partially true. Stalin urged the people leave nothing but a desert in the wake of their retreat. The speech ended with a reference to Napoleon's fate in his Russian campaign of 1812 to that of Kaiser Wilhelm II in the First World War. Both had enjoyed a reputation of invincibility, and both had been defeated in the end. On July 19th, Stalin personally took over the direction of the Commissariat of Defense and thereby became Commander-in-Chief of the Army. The actual leadership of the armed forces was in the hands of headquarters. You know, that's a mistake a lot of these people make. You know, Hitler made it, trying to micromanage the war, and Stalin did the same thing, which was directed by Chief of the General Staff. This post had for some time been occupied by General Shaporonskov, a holdover from the Tsarist general staff. He was an able military theoretician and a tireless worker. He became indispensable to Stalin by his almost servile eagerness to serve, not by his wealth of ideas. Thus, from the beginning of the military leadership was in essence entirely concentrated in Stalin's person, even though this may not have first been true for the administrative details of military planning. The actual direction of the high command of the army was entrusted to General Zhukov. In August 42, the importance of his position was stressed by his appointment as Deputy Commissar for Defense. Russia did not have a system of defense similar to that of the French in the West. The often mentioned Stalin line actually consisted merely of the swamps near Pinsk, near the old Polish-Russian border. The only defense plans which held any promise of success were based on the nature of the Russian terrain. As in the days of Napoleon, Russians relied on the size of the country and on the hard winters. Space must be yielded so that the time might be gained. Where resistance was in vain, where retreat had become inevitable, scorched earth must be left behind to greet the enemy. Not one locomotive, not one railway carriage, not one pound of flour, not one can of gasoline must fall into the hands of the Germans. Thus Stalin expressed the idea on July 3rd. The farmers were told to lead away the cattle to get the grain ready for removal. Whatever could not be moved was to be destroyed. This was the atmosphere at which the Russian retreat from June to December took place, a retreat which led to the gates of Moscow. However, it differed in character from that of the Polish and French armies. The Germans had met an adversary whose leaders were determined to resist to the very end. Would the people put up total resistance expected of them? This was the decisive question of the war. Stalin called upon the people to wage guerrilla war. There we go. He demanded that in the areas occupied by the enemy, guerrilla units be formed, mounted, and on foot. They were to harass the enemy unceasingly, to cripple him by sabotage, to blow up bridges, and to set fire to warehouses and trucks and rolling stock and so on. For years, the population had been trained in guerrilla fighting. Now it had a chance to prove its mettle in the wide area between the Baltic and the Black Seas. See, that was very wise of the Russians, to train the population in guerrilla warfare. And I, rather than worrying about whether Trump becomes president, white Aryans in this country should be tactically and maybe to a degree physically training for what may come. And the only thing that will work, the only way it can slow it down once we get into that area, is going to be guerrilla warfare. That's the only thing. Okay. The population, the Russian population, was first paralyzed by the lightning successes of the Germans. Then suddenly anti-Bolshevist sentiment burst into the open, particularly in non-Russian Western territories. It was especially striking in the Baltic countries, but also in eastern Poland and Bessarabia, among the white Ruthenians and the Ukrainians. In many places, the German troops were greeted as liberators. You see, that's another reason why there may be some bad feelings between the Russians and the Ukrainians today. Tremendous possibilities opened up for the German Eastern policy, provided the principles of psychological warfare were properly applied. Several alternatives existed: to play the trump of the liberation of the border states, to endow the fighting with the character of a crusade against Bolshevism, as Marshal Foch had envisioned in 1919, to establish an anti-Bolshevik Russian fascist regime, or to attempt to unscrupulously divide it imperial policy and divide Russia into nation states. Hitler did not follow any of these policies consistently. His real goal was to colonize the country and exploit its manpower. German edition of Alsdorf's book about British methods of subjugating India had become a textbook for the Nazis. Russia was probably scheduled to become the German India. At first, the Ukrainian site for secession was encouraged in line with the German plans for the Ukraine during the First World War in the 30s. This was done to bait its population with the concept of a powerful, autonomous Ukrainian state from the Carpathians to the Caucasus, but these pretenses were soon abandoned, and by 1942, German colonization plans were launched openly. It's interesting what they... It's a little bit like what's going on today over there in Ukraine. A number of decrees were characteristic of a spirit of National Socialism as it manifested itself in the Eastern policy. Well, in warfare, and at this point, I don't believe you can call it National Socialism because it's a war footing, and it's primarily based in with capitalist manufacturing, you know, so and heavy industry. So the so-called National Socialists of Germany were in bed with all the big shot Krupps and so forth, Thyssen's, and all of them, which is not my idea of what National Socialism was all about, or should have been about. As early as May 1341, a decree provided that captured commissars be liquidated without trial. The so-called Communist Decree of September 16th provided that for every German soldier killed in the occupied territory, 50 to 100 communists were to be shot. The Hostages Decree on October 1st authorized the taking of hostages among non-communists as well. The Undercover of Night Decree of December 7th provided that in case of acts of terror or sabotage, the civilian population was to be deported as unobtrusively as possible by the so-called security service for use in the German armament industry. They were going to just hijack massive numbers of Russians and these other countries that were close to Russia. In other words, virtually make them slaves in the German war industry. Not much for the workers there. A decree of December 1942 authorized reprisals against the relatives of saboteurs. And the gang decree of December 16, 1942 enabled the chief of gang suppression to adopt drastic measures against the guerrillas. I believe that's exactly what will happen in this country if things explode. Almost the same thing, or probably the same words, that you and I and everybody that's resisted this illegal and corrupt system will be automatically part of the gang laws and be attempted to be hunted down. Don't think it can't happen. It can happen real quick. And with the information on the economy that's been leaking through, it could happen any minute because the collapse of the financial situation in this country is could be very close at hand because we find now that some of the big bankers are taking their own money out of their own banks. Yeah. Reichsleiter. Hey, that's my name, Leiter. That was on my mother's side, my grandmother's side. Leiter, L-E-I-T-E-R, means leader. Alfred Rosenberg, himself born in Russia, had an anticipation been appointed commissar of the occupied eastern territories on April 21st, 1941, and this of course was a major mistake. Even if they'd have won the war, to replace the citizenry of Russia with Germans instead of having just, you know, free enterprise set up where people could move into Russia and buy property and start farming and all that kind of stuff. No. This Rosenberg, he wanted to physically suppress them all and just take their land. So that's why I wonder why some of these guys can join up with the NSM and people like that if they read and understand the whole story. in the first flush of the advance of special ministry of the Eastern Territories headed by Rosenberg was created on July 7. The political war aims in the East were worked out by his ministry. The product was confused. There were overlapping and mutual contradiction plans and ideas, poorly thought out, immature in concept. Rosenberg started with the basic idea of a national disintegration of the Soviet Union, according to which the state as a whole was to be dissolved into several areas, the Ukraine, the Caucasus Federation, and so forth, in order to prevent Russia from ever again becoming a threat to Western Europe. Well, you see, that's what was his name, the Jew in the White House, wanted to do with Germany, you see? Seems like all these people get carried away. Whether the Baltic states and the Ukraine, or that was Morgenthau wanted to do that to Germany, whether the Baltic states and the Ukraine were to become independent or protectorates of Germany, what was to become of Poland and the eastern Polish territories was never spelled out. Well, all that, as far as I'm concerned, is pie in the sky, because it might have worked out for a while, but the Russian nationalist people were not going to last under that kind of a setup for very long, because they would fight like I recommend fighting, guerrilla warfare to the death, either win or die, like the South should have done, and that's what I keep saying. Jefferson Davis wanted to fight on with a guerrilla force, and he should have, but I guess he was outvoted and didn't do it. But they could have beat the North. I'm not saying that's necessarily good or bad, but they could have beat the North, just like Ho Chi Minh beat the United States. Now, I know, oh no, we didn't lose in Vietnam. Well, we did lose in Vietnam, and they were willing to give up 1 million people dying. At least 1 million Vietnamese died, and they kept fighting. And they would have kept on fighting for 50 years if they'd have had to, and I admire that. Gradually, it became accepted that Germany was to be the chief beneficiary of the conquest. It became customary to speak of the Reich territories in which military colonies and fortified farms were to be set up. Oh, what do you call it? A bunch of Nazi kibbutzes. Yeah, wait a minute. Where did those Jews get that idea? Chiefly because of Rosenberg's fanatically anti-Christian attitude. Well, I can understand that. The promotion of a religious revival among the Russian population was rejected. Thus, a trump card, which could have had its political impact too, was left unused, a circumstance upon which Stalin soon seized. German military efforts to counteract and modify or even sabotage those political ineptitudes, as well as the immoral and inhuman terror, were no longer possible when the occupied territories passed into the hands of civil administration of the National Socialist Party. In the course of this development, the will to resist increased among the disillusioned population of the occupied territories. Yeah, they played, Germans played right into their hands. You know, that hard line suppression of the people. And Stalin had done the same thing for his side. But this is different because Germany attacked Russia, and when Stalin was suppressing people, it was an internal situation. This became more and more evident as the German troops, after marching through the White Russian and Ukrainian regions, entered the great Russian provinces beyond Smolensk. Soon, partisan warfare flared behind the front, creating ever-increasing difficulties for the Germans, you see? They weren't able to bring the Germans to their knees necessarily because of guerrilla warfare, but they sure as hell let them know they were around. The problems of, you know, I hear a lot of National Socialists, they whine about how brutal these guerrilla warfare people were. Well, you invaded my country, you asshole. You get what you get. Cut your head off, feed it to the dogs. I mean, you know, same way should have been if Russia would have attacked and invaded Germany. You fight for your land. If you don't fight for your land, you don't fight for anything. Although Churchill had predicted to the day the beginning of the German attack on the Soviet Union, well, that's because of the man called Lucy. Now, that goes back to a book we were reading to you months ago. What the hell was his name? I can't remember now. Sorry about that. But anyhow, the man called Lucy sitting down there in Switzerland. He knew the battle. He knew when Hitler was going to attack. He knew all that stuff. And he told Stalin, but Stalin was too suspicious of anybody that he didn't believe him. Well, after a few big battles were lost, Stalin believed him. But you should, if you haven't read The Man Called Lucy, you'll understand a lot more of this. After a discussion with Sir Stafford Cripps, the British ambassador to Moscow, recently returned to London for consultations, Churchill drafted, as he related his memoirs, a major speech in which he promised extensive aid to Russia. Yeah, how's he going to give extensive aid to Russia? I know he can give aid to Russia, but extensive aid? England wasn't that good a shape. I mean, they had a lot of industry, that's for sure. No, Churchill was already looking at Roosevelt to back him up. No one, he said, has been more consistently an opponent of communism than I have for the last 25 years. I unsay no word that I have spoken about it, but all this fades away before the spectacle which is now unfolding. On July 12th, a mutual assistance pact was concluded between the two countries, in which both parties undertook not to enter into any separate negotiations with the enemy. In the United States, a similar mood prevailed. Here, too, it was believed that all doubts had to be cast aside in favor of common action against Hitler. British as well as the American military experts took a most pessimistic view of the prospects of Russian resistance. In view of the devastating crisis of the Red Army had undergone in the purges of 37, that was a stupidity and narcissism of Stalin, and its performance in the Finnish winter campaign, and the known power of the German Blitz campaigns, it seemed impossible that the German troops should be tied down in the East more than 3 months. More perceptive was the memorandum of Joseph E. Davies, former United States ambassador to Moscow. As early as July 8th, he foresaw the difficulties in which Hitler would have to deal in the occupied territories as guerrilla warfare and sabotage commenced. I mean, you know, when you're an organized professional army and you're moving through countryside to where you don't know what people are, whether they're friendly or foe, and they're mostly unfriendly, and they can attack you at any time, they can set traps for you at any time, they can sniper you, then you know you can't even sit down to have a meal without getting a bullet in your head. That's a terrorism that works against a major force. Even after the loss of the Ukraine and White Russia, Stalin could, in his opinion, hold on for quite some time in the Urals. In fact, that's where he was going to take the whole Russian government over into the Urals for a last-ditch stand against Hitler. However, after Stalingrad, he didn't have to do that. After the stupidity of Stalingrad. However, one had to bear in mind also that in such a situation, Stalin's well-known realism might lead to a separate German-Russian peace. Stalin was in any case informed that the Western powers determined to defeat Hitler were prepared to collaborate with the Soviet Union on a friendly basis. Oh, man. Oh, they threw it all away. In fact, the war between Germany and Russia still affects us today, things that came out of that war. Don't think it ended then. It's still bugging us today. in order to obtain a true picture of the Soviet Union's actual resistance potential and of Stalin's intentions, Roosevelt sent Harry Hopkins, who was a Jew that was well planted in the White House. Not necessarily a Jew, but a communist. Harry Hopkins was a communist. He was right there. He lived in the White House. His longtime associate and confidant to Moscow in July 1941. Well, he sends the communist to Moscow to deal with the communists. With instructions from the British as well, Hopkins flew from Scotland via Archangelsk to Moscow. I'm butchering a lot of these names. I mean, they're impossible. And they managed to gain Stalin's confidence to a considerable degree. Well, of course, they agreed on everything, or most of it. He explained to Stalin that the American government was fully determined to give the Soviet Union all possible aid as quickly as possible. Hell yes. All the liberals in the country and all of them give Stalin anything he wants. Stalin himself described the situation and needs of the Red Army with frankness unexemplared in recent Soviet history. He deeply impressed Hopkins by the lucid precision of his statements. He asked for anti-aircraft guns, machine guns, rifles, fuel, and aluminum. He said that the safest transport route was via the Arctic route. On July 30th, he told Hopkins that he had not believed that Hitler would attack, but nevertheless had taken all precautions. The Germans had underestimated the strength of the Russian army, which at several points was moving to counterattack. Hopkins could not help but notice how desperately serious the situation was. Well, you see, if they hadn't got all that stuff through Murmansk and on the eastern coast, the American stuff, probably even with the fall of the debacle at Leningrad, the Germans would have still beat him. Stalin had to admit that 75% of the armament plants were located in the areas around Leningrad, Moscow, and Kiev. These areas were already directly threatened by the enemy. Stalin said that the war would certainly be hard, perhaps long, and that one thing alone could assure the defeat of Hitler, the entry of the United States into the war. Whoopee. Hopkins left Moscow with the conviction that the Soviet government was ready to put up a determined fight and that with American help was therefore called for. His report considerably fortified Roosevelt in his intention to support the Soviet Union's resistance. American aid, based on the Lend-Lease Agreement, was to become decisive in Russian defense against German attack. Of course, all this Lend-Lease bullshit, they just gave it to them. We never got paid back. It was given promptly and effectively. Just a week after the Germans attacked, a committee had been created to organize aid to the Soviet Union. In July, Roosevelt ordered the shipments for Russia be immediately prepared. Under the direction of Colonel P.A. Faymonville, the American Army's foremost expert on Russian conditions, $145 million worth of goods were made ready for Russia in the first 3 months alone. In September 1941, W. Averell Harriman, and he's the guy who ran for president about 10 times and lost, headed a mission to Moscow to investigate the Soviet Union's needs. Lord Beaverbrook accompanied Harriman as the British representative. Negotiations were difficult. Even then, Stalin hinted at the demand, which later was to wind its way like a bright thread through the history of collaboration against Hitler. He asked for the opening of a second front in the West in order to relieve the Russian front. During those critical days when the front was hourly moving closer to Moscow, the visitors could notice unmistakable signs of nervousness in Stalin. Just as he had previously told Hopkins that American troops, even under exclusively American command, would be welcome in every sector of the Russian front, he now asked Beaverbrook whether Great Britain could not send some of her troops to the Ukraine. When Beaverbrook proposed a transfer of British troops from Persia via the Caucasus, Stalin eternally distrustful, and perhaps remembering the British advance along the same line during the Civil War in 1918-19, rejected the offer. The principal items of the agenda concerned the deliveries of war supplies and raw material. They were summed up in the so-called Moscow Protocol. The United States undertook to supply Russia with $1 trillion worth of goods in the course of 1942. Do you think that might have had a little bit to do with the outcome of the war? That's one with three sets of zeros. I think that's a trillion, or at least a billion. On November 7th, Roosevelt described the Soviet Union as a suitable partner for a lend-lease agreement. And there we go, bleeding the American worker. See, bleeding American worker. Established an interest-free credit of $1 billion repayment to begin 5 years after the cessation of hostilities. Right. Did the taxpayers ever get a dime of that from the Russians? Bullshit. After the United States entered the war, it was, of course, vitally interested in the Soviet Union's successful prosecution of the war. The provisional agreements of 41 were supplemented to that of the final Lend-Lease Agreement, defined the American aid program, of which the Soviet High Command could make use until 45. In order to expedite shipments of special order issues by Roosevelt on March 7, 1942, released all material promised in the Soviet or Moscow Protocol. It was to be shipped without delay and ahead of any commitments. Do you realize how many men died, merchant marine died on those ships, taking that shit around through the ice and all that to get to the eastern shores there of Russia? They lost hundreds of ships and hundreds of men. It was to be shipped without delay and ahead of any other commitments. The Soviet Union was the given priority in the allocation of war materials over all the other allies, even over the United States' own armed forces. A special presidential protocol committee headed by Hopkins, that's the fox watching the chicken house, administrated aid to the Russian program. Now, you see, then 1945, the Germans collapsed, and what are we doing? Immediately, we're in a money-making war with military-industrial complex is already set up to make a fortune in a shadow war with Russia. See, this is all about money. Maybe not all about money, but it's mainly about money. War is very profitable. So here Roosevelt is just taking these arbitrary acts and draining the resources of the United States, even the U.S. Army, and there are people making a fortune on weapons. And then in 45 it all reverses and we go to Russia's the bad guy. And billions and billions are made by the military-industrial complex. You see how it's so simple to see through, it's makes you want to cry. Yeah. That happens all the time. You have an enemy, and you spend all kinds of money trying to defeat the enemy, and then you defeat the enemy, and then you spend all that money, put them back together. Just like that stupid thing in Iraq. We're going to take over Iraq and rebuild Iraq, you know. Iraq never got rebuilt. It got blown apart many times. That's why you should not support the military-industrial complex in any manner whatsoever. You should be totally opposed to that war budget of about $1 trillion every year. You have nothing to gain at all by supporting the Republican Party hawks and the Democrat Party hawks. They should all be gotten out of office if at all possible. Even Trump is making statements like, we're going to make our military the strongest in the world. Well, shit, we got enough. I don't know how it could be much stronger, how many more atomic bombs you could have, how many missiles you could have, how many tanks you could have, how many ships you can have. But Trump is saying, well, I'm even going to make it bigger. Well, that's the military-industrial complex will make a lot more money. But the average American and average white American saying, oh, wow, that's wonderful. He's wonderful. He's going to build more military ships and armaments and bombs and all that shit, man. And we'll all be working, making military things and airplanes and all that, you know. And then maybe one of these days we'll just bomb the shit out of somebody. Well, that's a big book, but it's got a hell of a lot of facts. I think everybody that's interested in how we get in these messes and how we never seem to get out of them, that go on and on and on and on, bankrupt the country, bankrupt us as individuals, and it just keeps going on and on. On and on and on. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday, and we'll talk about it a little more, maybe something else. Sometimes it's so painful to think about this kind of stuff and read about it, you almost have to change the subject once in a while. Incidentally, I think I've got a book in my library on Russian partisan warfare. We're going to have to get into that one of these days, too. Very interesting. One other thing. There's a film I saw yesterday, available in a rental shop, but it's called Alabama Moon, and it's about a kid and his father that his father is very paranoid about the government. He hates the government, doesn't want to be have anything to do with the government. They're living out in the woods in a cave, and due to circumstances, the father dies, and this little 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid is left to his own deserts, but he's learned tremendous amount of survival skills to the point where they finally capture him and put him in a home for kids, a county home for kids, and he leads an escape of about 50 of the other little kids into the woods, and they go out and live in the woods. I think you'll really enjoy that film. It's Alabama Moon.